Hello and welcome to another edition of Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen.
My purpose as a leader is to help leaders find joy, fulfillment, and impact while they build high-trust, high-performance teams that honor people, defy the critics, and thrive in the face of adversity. I've been walking that talk and living into that purpose for 40 years. I find it remarkably fulfilling. And just to see people have these moments where they've gone a step further than they might have gone is just so fulfilling to me.
My guest, Doug Conant, has shown enormous resilience in his personal and professional life, which propelled him forward on his leadership journey. Former president and CEO of the Campbell Soup Company, today he draws on his incredible resume and wealth of experience to help aspiring executives hone and master the art of leadership. In his latest book, The Blueprint, he sets out his manifesto and practical manual for leaders, which puts trust and honoring people right at the very center. It was such an incredible joy to speak to him, and I got so much out of the conversation about how to deal with tough times, importance of stepping out of your comfort zone, and building strong networks, and how to nurture those relationships that will support you all along the way. There's lots of clear practical advice that I know you'll find useful. So stay with us. It's a real deep pleasure to have you on the podcast, Doug. A warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I wish I could take you around with me and have you introduce me wherever I go. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you about your upbringing. You grew up in the suburbs of Chicago with three younger brothers and a competitive drive as a tennis player. You describe yourself as an introvert growing up. And I think you even had to pay your Northwestern College by becoming the tennis coach assistant. So can you tell us a bit more about those formative years and how those experiences have shaped you?
I am the oldest of four boys, and my father was traveling much. And so my mother basically had to raise four very rowdy boys, which was not easy. As the oldest, I was sort of in charge of the next two oldest while she was taking care of the baby. And early on, I realized how difficult it was to be a leader. I mean, very early on, if you think about it, and I'll speak about my family today. I have three children. Yeah. My wife and I have three children. And to get all five of us, just five of us, to agree on anything in a particular direction is a miracle. Then you start dealing with thousands of people who you don't know nearly as well as the people in your own right. family unit. And you see what a challenge it is to lead when people have their own perspectives and their own minds. So I saw that, I discovered that very early on. Tennis was an outlet for me. As an introvert, you're uncomfortable with people. And I certainly was, but I discovered I could hit a tennis ball against a wall for a long time, and it did exactly what I wanted it to do, and I didn't have to talk to anyone. I found it was excellent preparation for life in terms of learning that pressure was a privilege, a Billie Jean King quote, and learning to perform under pressure when you're the only one out there on the court and everyone's watching, and you have to own the performance. You have to own it.
Absolutely.
And you quickly learn that if you want to own the performance on the court, you have to own the preparation before you go on the court. Hmm. I became relatively proficient at it. I was one of the best players in the Midwest United States. That earned me a scholarship to Northwestern University, where I played. And that paid for my education. And then I had the opportunity to work for the tennis coach right after I graduated and get my graduate school paid for. And I had a great education, and tennis facilitated a lot of that, both just economic, financially, but also in terms of my learned experience.
When you had to step up as a coach assistant, I guess you had to combat your timidity and being introverted to start taking initiative with others, maybe giving advice, maybe leading. Was it a stretch for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. At around the same time, I was taking a public speaking course at Kellogg the first year.
Uh-huh.
And yep. I got up for my first speech and I couldn't talk.
You couldn't talk at all.
It was embarrassing. I had the whole class there and I froze. That was where I started. I'm obviously more comfortable speaking now, but it's taken me 50 years to work my way into it. I would say that I did learn something, though. I learned that if I had a deep, abiding knowledge of a subject, I had the courage to speak up.
Yeah.
And I knew tennis. You know, there's this wonderful Maya Angelou quote about courage. She says, courage is the most important trait. Without courage, you can't practice anything else with consistency. So I'm big on having courage, but it's hard to have the courage of your convictions if you don't know what your convictions are. So that was something I learned as a coach, that I needed to really know the content and the people in order to have the courage, being an introvert, to have the courage to step into the arena and speak.
I'm an introvert myself as well. I used to be very, very shy. A bit like you, I mean, my journey has been about, well, first of all, getting some, basically some knowledge, deep knowledge about a topic.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically content, matter expertise, then being able to build convictions based on that and confidence, and then being able to exercise some courage because of that stronger base. So I'm with you 100%,
yeah.
And it feels familiar to me as well in terms of the experience.
Yeah.
So let's build on that dialogue, Doug, and because early on in your career, when you were a bit older, you were 32, basically you were fired from your job at Parker Brothers Toys and Games.
Yes.
It was a big shock, difficult experience in many ways, because you had young children and mortgage to pay. So can you take me back to that day and describe what happened and explain how it was a crucible moment for you?
Well, you know, we all have these crucible moments, and that this was certainly one of mine. And on one hand, you wouldn't wish these moments on anyone. On the other hand, it was probably the most important learning experience I had in my career. I went into the office one day feeling just fine. The receptionist said, can you go up to see the senior vice president? He needs to meet with you first thing. I went up to see him. I was director of marketing. And I had a great job. I mean, we were selling toys and games. I was director of marketing. We had all this cool new stuff, Monopoly, all kinds of electronic games, music, books. Yeah. And I was the most popular dad on the block. When I would come home, they wanted to see what toy I'd brought home. And I was living the life. And I go up there and he says, Doug, your job's been eliminated. You need to be out of here by noon. And 10 years of my career was over in a snap. I went home to my wife, our two very small children, and my very large mortgage, feeling quite the victim. And they called me later that day to tell me my benefits. And after the first time I swore at the head of HR and hung up on him, I called him back and realizing I really need to get a job. So
some help.
He connected me with an outplacement counselor. This outplacement counselor was a real gift to me. I called him late that day. He said, can you come see me right now? I said, but it's 5 o'clock. I'd love to make an appointment. I very thoughtful of you to invite me over to come to your office at the dinner hour.
Yeah.
It's about a half hour away. He said, no, you come over right now and we're going to talk this thing through.
So Doug drove over to see the outplacement counselor, a guy called Neil McKenna. And he ended up staying for 3 hours.
And he was there for me, and he was there for me completely. And I discovered how important it is when people go through these crucible moments to be aware that they're going through difficulty and to be there for them completely. And I started to turn that corner that night.
Weeks later, Neil made Doug handwrite his life story, reflecting on all the experiences that had influenced the path he had chosen. It was something Doug had never considered doing. But for Doug, it was life-changing. And it set him off on a new path.
He said, Doug, you're presenting yourself as an introvert, and you're only answering the questions that are asked. You're not animated at all. You're just telling me what you think I want to hear. I'm not seeing the real Doug Conan. And I said, I think you need to get in touch with the real Doug Conan. I want you to write your life story. And I want everything. And I want it handwritten because I want you to think about what you're writing.
Every single word. Yeah, yeah. How did you do that, by the way, Doug? I'm curious. I mean, is it something that you had to do just obviously by yourself? At the time, you were not using ChatGPT to help you write your own story.
There was nothing.
No, it was nothing. Just, but did you talk to yourself, to your wife, to your friends, just you?
You know, I think it was important that it was my journey. I think I had to travel back and recall and pull out all the important things that I had learned in my childhood. And I discovered that my family had come to this country in a very challenging times and had persevered and had found ways to make their way through five generations of citizenship here. And they had grit. They had determination. They had creativity in terms of how they found ways to navigate life. My family, half of them had come from the Irish potato famine in Ireland, the other half from England, and were escaping religious persecution. And when I was done, I turned it into him. In 2 weeks, I had written 50 pages, both sides. I turned it into him and he read it. And then he said, Doug, this is very interesting to me. We're preparing, helping prepare you to interview for jobs. And I see that Doug Conan. And then I read this amazing Doug Conan, who's a world-class tennis player, who's passionate, whose family has come from nothing to pioneer life in the United States. These are two different people. You need to be one. You need to bring your whole self to work, and people need to see it, feel it, and hear it, because you have the power to make a real difference. That was what that experience started me on my journey, and it changed my life.
The value of writing your life story is something that often comes up in conversation with guests. It allows us to see events in our lives and ourselves from a new perspective, giving us a deeper understanding and appreciation for who we are and the life choices we've made. And Doug was open to hearing that advice from Neil because he felt Neil knew him in a way that no one else did. Neil remained a mentor for Doug until he passed away in 1996. You know, last September, I had on this podcast, I think a friend of yours, Bill George, former Harvard business professor and best-selling author of Finding Your True North. And he's someone who also places, of course, as you know, a great deal of value in writing your life story as something that helps you to find and envision your intentions, your purpose. So in your book, and you just mentioned that, Doug, you talked about your own values, which you said underpin the whole process. And you mentioned how surprised people are when you ask them to do it themselves and that they discover that they have many, let's say, unconscious values that if they had been holding or hiding some case, but had not fully realized. So can you talk about how it can be a way of getting to know your internal world in a deeper sense and a way of building resilience? Because in many ways, the way you did and you wrote down those words and then activated the new Doug, which is something else, is actually embodying the words you've been writing is like a big, big transformation. How is that happening?
Well, I've done this work with thousands of people now. And in my experience, our life story sort of gets put in the parking lot. Because we are trying to grow and to be the person that Microsoft wants us to be, or in my case, that General Mills wanted me to be, or Kraft Foods, or RJR Nabisco, or Campbell Soup, or Avon Products. In all those places, they are telling you how they want you to be. Yeah. And as you're being acculturated into those cultures, you start to lose sight of who you want to be because you're trying to meet the needs of the organization, right? And we find that if we have people write their life story, it's the first step in the blueprint. And the second step is then reflect on the lessons from that story. Those first two steps, you can envision a future that's helping you become the best version of yourself you can be. It's almost impossible to do that if you don't mine your life story first. Because all of this, what has been called all this primary greatness is in you already. We just have to find it. And we don't actually have to find it. You have to find it. And you have to go into your life story so that I have found there are ways with prompts and guidance to mine your life story in a manageable way without having to handwrite 50 pages. Although, if you have time, that's very worthwhile. To go into that parking lot and find where you actually parked the car in that very full parking lot and find the things that matter most, I think it's essential for you to become whole as a leader.
Yeah. 100% agree with you, Doug. And I'm sure you know this very famous quote, watch your thoughts before they become your words. Watch your words before they become, I think, your habits. Watch your habits before they become your destiny. To me, what is the most challenging thing is actually after you verbalize through the words your story of your life, how do you translate that into your habits and into your destiny?
Yeah, but that can be done. That can be done. We are really good planners. We can have a plan for our software. We can have a plan for a rollout. We can have a plan to get into new jobs. We can build a plan, man. We are really good planners. And then I'll talk to someone and I say, what's your plan for your career? What? You know, you got to be kidding me. You know, that should be job one. I'm telling you, most leaders are leading by the seat of their pants. They have no plan. And you can't just go from here's the leader I want to be with purpose and go to, okay, what habits am I going to have? Yeah. I think you're skipping a few steps. You need to, my belief is you envision your future, which is reflecting and then figuring out how you want to show up. You study the world around you as you would if you were doing a situation assessment for a business challenge. Yep. You build a plan. And then you say, okay, the next step is how am I going to bring this plan to life with intention? And that becomes the practices and the behaviors. And then in the spirit of continuous improvement, any leader would tell you, you say, okay, how did that go? How can I do better? And you go back to the beginning and you revisit it.
Iterate.
But the gap here is that I find leaders don't have a plan. They're lost in the desert. And it's like, shame on you. You have so much capacity. This is your one life. Come on, let's lean into this. Let's make a plan that actually grows out of who you are and who you hope to become in a way that serves your enterprise. And there are ways to do this, but we've got to do it with intention. We cannot just do it by the seat of our pants.
I'm sticking to the same story, and I think it applies beyond the professional life itself. I think, Doug, it applies to our whole life as one life, right? Transcending professional, personal, and social life together. Ideally, you want to bring that all together in one plan, as opposed to many, many plans, I guess.
Well, that's how. David Brooks, the New York Times social commentator, has his book, The Second Mountain. He talks about building your resume and writing your eulogy and how do those things come together as one. And that's what we're talking about. When you pass away, people are not going to talk about your career accomplishments. They're going to talk about your career, your life contributions and how you've affected those around you. And I think we do need to bring it together as one. But I also believe we can. It will never be elegantly perfect. Yeah. Because as Jim Collins used to say, perfect is the enemy of good. But it can be good and getting better all the time in the spirit of continuous improvement.
I love it. So let's come back as well to your own life story development. So You moved from the refrigerator division of Kraft to take care of Nabisco biscuits, moving from marketing to sales, eventually president of Nabisco, before being back to Kraft, which acquired Nabisco. So it's an incredible kind of business story as well. And then you were approached to become the CEO of Campbell's Soup Company. That must have felt like an enormous step at the time. So tell me about those early days as you, again, joined the company to become the CEO.
Sure.
And the challenge you faced to reset Campbell, because I think it was a full reset you had to do.
Well, I was at Kraft for 7 years. After I was fired, it took me a year because I was a terrible interview. But I got a job with Kraft, and I had it for 7 years. And once I got into Kraft, and I didn't have to interview anymore, I did pretty well, and I became head of corporate strategy at Kraft. And the CEO, a fellow by the name of Jim Kilts, fantastic CEO, loved me being in strategy, but I hungered to be leading the business and helping lift the company to greater heights. And I had a team of 3 to 5 people trying to chart strategy, which was interesting, but insufficient. I did it for 3 years. And then I was recruited into RJR Nabisco right after Barbarians at the Gate, the largest LBO in history to this day in the consumer products industry, a $25 billion LBO in 1989. And I went in there, and that was like the Wild West. While I was there, I got a general manager job. I just took the job because I was fascinated by the challenge of going into what I would call the Shark Tank in New York City after I was working for a Midwestern Chicago-based food company. I went to the Shark Tank. I took the smallest division they had as a general manager, and I was loving it. And before I knew it, they said, "We'd like to move you to marketing in the biscuit division." And I said, "I don't want to do that. I want to be a general manager." This felt like a bait and switch. They said, "We need you to go there." So I went. We had a great run. We went from horrible performance to the best performance in the history of the company in terms of revenue growth and earnings growth in an LBO environment in 2 years. Then they said, "Well, you did good there. Now we want you to move to sales." And I said, "Do I have a choice? I'm riding the wave here. We finally got this right." And the CEO said, "Yes, you have a choice." And I said, "Well, I don't want to go." The next day, I get a phone call from Rita, who was the CEO's executive assistant. And I said, "Rita, what is this call about?" She said, "Well, John would like to see you." And I said to her, I said, "Rita, do I have a choice today?" She said, "No, yesterday you had a choice. Today you're going to take the job." So I went in, and I had declined the job when he first offered it to me. I said, "You got to be kidding me. I am not a salesman. I'm an introvert and I can't play golf. Why in the world do you want me talking to customers?" He said, "Well, we need some thought leadership here as well as some interpersonal leadership, and we think you're the guy for the job." So the second time I said I'd love to do it because I knew I didn't have a choice. And I did that, and that led me to becoming president of Nabisco Foods. We transformed the sales organization. Then we were acquired by Kraft, the company I had left, at which point I said, "I can't go back. You know, it's like going back to a high school reunion. I could not go back to high school again. I need to be moving forward." So I was recruited to be CEO of Campbell. Campbell at the time was headquartered in the poorest, most dangerous city in the United States, a little place called Camden, New Jersey. 75,000 people, 70 murders a year in a town of 75,000 people. The world headquarters was surrounded by razor wire and had guard posts, ostensibly to make you feel safe, but you felt like you were going to work in a minimum security prison. They had lost half their market value in 1 year. They had downsized dramatically and were uncompetitive. Mm-hmm. We did the work to discover we were of the top 21 food companies in the world. We were the poorest performing one. Headquarters, most dangerous city in the United States.
Yeah.
And people were saying, "Why did you take this job?" Then we did a Gallup survey, which said, not only is your performance terrible, but your employee engagement is the worst in the Fortune 500.
The bottom.
At the bottom. Yeah. Number 500 out of 500.
When Doug started at Campbell, the culture was toxic and morale was low. Sales for its largest product line, condensed soups, had declined amid intense competition, and the company was rumored to be close to a takeover from a rival. So Doug set himself a mission to take the company's bad performance and lift it to extraordinary. He did it by keeping employee engagement front and center. The first thing he did was to listen to the employees to get their feedback on what was not working. And he made changes that earned their trust. Trusting people and honoring them is at the core of Doug's leadership framework. And listening to him reminds me of a great conversation I had recently with Stephen M. R. Covey on the podcast about his book on being a trust and inspire leader. Stephen talks about three key steps: modeling who we are, trusting how we lead, and inspiring based on a connection to our why. There are some really strong correlations between what Stephen and Doug are talking about. And I would really recommend you to listen to Stephen's episode if you have not already. But there's something very special and specific in a way that Doug honors people. For decades now, he's been writing notes to people. People who he might not see otherwise to say thank you.
It wasn't just wishing them happy birthday or something, but they had done something good for our company and I wanted to acknowledge it and let them know I was paying attention and that it was appreciated. I find that all of our organizations are great critical thinking machines. We're built to find what's wrong and fix it. But even in the most broken companies I've been in, two of which were an old economy canned soup company and the world's largest LBO, even in those companies, 8 out of 10 things were being done right, but nobody was talking about those things. So I needed to bring balance. So I started writing 10 to 20 notes a day to employees 6 days a week. I had a process where I was in a car 2.5 hours going to work every day. I would write 10 to 20 notes to people, small, short notes on specific subjects. And they would go out that day based on information I had learned the prior day. So it was on time, handwritten, personal. And when I retired, I was asked how many notes I had written. I had no idea. So we did the math, and it turned out at least just to Campbell employees, I'd written 30,000 notes, and we only had 20,000 employees. So wherever you would go in the world, in the 38 countries, you would see one of my notes tacked up in a cubicle say, thank you for helping out on this project or over-delivering the quarter on sales and earnings or whatever it was. Do you think people noticed over time? You think all my direct reports said, do you expect us to write notes? I said, no, but I do expect you to celebrate contributions of significance. This is more than just problem solving. This is company building. And we've got to build a culture that celebrates what's working while we deal with all the stuff that's not working.
So, I mean, there's no mystery the way you basically came with Campbell Soup from the bottom of the pack, right, in terms of employee engagement to the very top in a few years, because you basically did it, you meant it, one employee at a time, which is quite amazing, actually, in terms of the intention and the practice you built into the company. I found some interesting similarities in the way you reshape Campbell culture and the way we evolve our culture at Microsoft. You know, back in 2014, when Satya Nadella and all of us transformed our company into a cloud and AI-first organization with a new mission to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. So can you elaborate on the culture framework you've designed and, more importantly, the way you made it real with your people? Because I think it takes more than a slide and some words on a slide to shape or create or reinvigorate the culture, and particularly getting all of your employees, again, to engage, to be motivated, and to bring their best version of themselves. What did it take?
It was a heavy lift. to put it in perspective, we were also, in addition to all the other things, we were being investigated by the U.S. government, multiple agencies for financial malfeasance while we were dealing with everything else. And my foundational belief is you can't ask associates to care about the enterprise until you first demonstrate that you care about them and their agenda. Absolutely. They got to come first. And then you earn credibility and respect, and they start to lean into the proposition of the enterprise. And in my opinion, what you did at Microsoft is you reaffirmed the value of every person. You honored them in a way that was noticeable. And that's what I tried to do at Campbell. And I had a lot of practices that did that. But it was really about placing a premium on honoring people, on demonstrating that we cared, and then that we brought it to life in tangible ways, tangible actions. When Jim Collins did his Good to Great work, he identified two characteristics of his level five leaders. They really spoke to me as an introvert. I think they speak to you too. The two characteristics of enduring successful companies were humility and fierce resolve. So we, with all humility, we said, we're in this together. We're going to have to lift ourselves up. We are going to see this through. We'll have realistic expectations, but we will be relentless. The first 3 years, we said we're going to go from being uncompetitive every day to being competitive on a good day. And it will take us 3 years in a highly developed consumer goods category, food, that food, is very competitive. We were in 38 countries. It was complex. We had realistic expectations, and then we had fierce resolve. The other thing we said was, every leader has to demonstrate that they have the capacity to inspire trust. Trust building was job one, not a nice to have, it was a must have. And we told all the leaders, particularly the top 350, that if you aren't building trust in your organization, we're going to measure it through Gallup, you are at risk. The first year,
whatever is your performance, right?
And the first year, I'm not even going to look at it. That's going to be your baseline. The second year, I'm going to look at it, and we're going to talk about it, every one of the 350. And the third year, we're going to act on the learning. And if you can't inspire the trust of the organization and deliver the performance, there were six expectations, but or five expectations, one, two, three, four, five, six. Six expectations. Six. First one was inspire trust. If you can't get with the program, we've got to find leaders that will. We'll move you into an individual contributor mode or something else. But in 3 years, we've got to transform this culture. And that means we've got to transform the leadership of this culture. And I don't think people expected me to last 3 years. I did. And we did transform the culture in those 3 years. But I think, as you know, ultimately, we turned over 300 of our top 350 leaders. I don't know. And think of Microsoft. 3 years,
it's huge.
300 of the top 350 left the organization.
Gigantic.
But on the other hand, I felt like a fiddler on the roof. There is no other hand. We have to make these changes or we won't survive. So we did, and we survived, and then we thrived.
Love the way you build that foundation of trust by honoring people. Doug, we'll come back to that because I think it's at the nucleus of your philosophy. So, you know, you and I were having a quick discussion the other day, Doug, on this very fast-changing world, you know, that we used to call VUCA, right? Volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. And, of course, you share with me that, hey, Jean-Philippe, you know, JP, this has changed. This is now Bani, right? Yeah. It's about brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. So can you share with our listeners, not just, of course, the context of Bani is quite interesting, but the way you've been shaping those three easy steps to become the best version of yourself, to become a leader. Because you made it super easy, like one, two, three. You started talking about a one. I'd love you to elaborate on the two and the three as well.
Sure. Well, first of all, every generation seems to need to have a new word for what the generation is going through. So this new word that I came, that I encountered in the last month or so, Bani, it speaks to me. I mean, and I'm in an office today in Washington, D.C., and the average age here is probably under 30. And they have never seen anything like this world. You and I have seen more, right? Yeah. We have experienced. But what I have learned is that of Benny, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible, A is the big word now. Anxiety is at an all-time high for generations of workers who have never faced this kind of chaos. And the volume of what's coming at them is greater. The speed at which it's coming at them is greater. And the architecture that is supporting them is crumbling.
It is.
And they used to be able to go, when I started, of course, I'm old, you're young. But you're younger anyway. You're not that young.
No, not that young.
I guess when I started, I used to be able to go to my manager and say, how do I do this? I'm not sure. Now you can't go ask your manager. Your manager doesn't know. They have 20 direct reports and they're coordinating and aligning and motivating, but they're not doing. The anxiety is an all-time high. And so what we say is, if you want to find your way through this, you've really got to get your rudder in the water, because I guarantee you the seas will get choppier. So what kind of leader do you want to be? That's the first thing. And it grows out of your leadership story and your reflection and a little bit on studying leaders around you who you can learn from. And then building a plan for how you want to move forward to become more effective, and then implementing some simple practices. And the key here is, I draw a lot of learning from James Clear and his book, Atomic Habits. There's a lot of writing on this. Mm-hmm. The key to this change process is it has to nest perfectly in your cockamamie life. You know, we all have diets that we're going to implement right after the holidays. And we do them with great rigor for 1 month, and then we can't sustain them.
Yep.
So what we try and do with this is keep it remarkably simple.
And he's gone. Yeah.
Figure out your purpose, figure out how you want to show up, and then find tiny habits or practices that can start to bring that version of yourself to life with the people with whom you live and work.
No, love it. Love those very smart advice, particularly these days. I'd like to shift gears and talk about the importance of support networks in helping us overcome adversity. I really like the idea of building up strong relationship, keeping regular contact, repaying favors, feeding mutual benefit relationship in good and bad times as well. So have you got some tips on how to start and maintain meaningful relationships, especially as you'll be able to relate to if you are naturally more introverted? That's not necessarily an obvious step.
Well, this is important. You know, they say, and you know this, they say leadership is lonely at the top. I find it was lonely at every level. But what I discovered was that it was only it didn't have to be. I was making a choice. I wasn't talking to anybody about it. And I discovered there were plenty of people who were interested in helping me as long as I respected them and honored them and didn't ask too much of them. So when I lost my job, I was challenged by my outplacement counselor, Neil McKenna, to build a network of people who could give me ideas and advice on my job search. Believe it or not, I was 33. I'm now 72. Some of those same people are in my network today.
Still today.
Still today. And we've all grown together. I could call them and help them, or they could call me and I would help. I mean, I think you want to build that relationship. And then you've got to, with intention, and it's not the intention to get something from it. It's all about having the intention to give something to it. I find the more I give, the more I get. So in this, in this network idea, build a network where you think you can be adding value, where you're always looking to add value. And then what I find is people are looking to add value to me. And so it's about giving, not getting. And I have found if I can get a reference from someone, if I contact someone, you give me the name of someone, and I send them an email and I say, JP suggested we talk. I'd love to get your ideas and advice on something. They'll take a call. And then if I'm clear about what I'm asking, they'll give me 5 to 10 minutes. And then I'll try and create some value for them. And then we'll see where it goes. And most often, those relationships will stick.
The value of those personal connections, of having a good support network, is key to building resilience and makes stress easier to manage. And it's fascinating to see how Doug's done it, honoring people, listening, writing those personal notes. It takes disciplines and time to build a good support network. And my advice is, if you're just starting on this, do it now, when you're fine, before you need it. Think of 5 people you would love to have in your network and how you can connect with them. Never be afraid to reach out. Just bear in mind, you should be looking to build a network where you think you can be adding value. It's about giving, not getting. In 2009, Doug, you're returning home from work at Campbell's, when you are involved in a near-fatal car crash. And daughter spent 18 hours putting your back together. Your wife stayed with you until you woke up from surgery, and you talk in the past about how she said 3 words that have made a huge impact on you and your leadership model. What were those words?
I was 59 years old. It was July 2nd, 2009. And I was in the ICU. They got my wife to the trauma center where I was being kept. And she would not leave my side. And she was right there. I woke up and she was holding my hand. She was the first person I saw, the first person I touched that I was cognizant. And she said 3 words to me. She said, "I'm right here." And she was there for me right when I needed her, right when I needed her. And that was another crucible moment in my life. And what I tell people is, metaphorically, the people we work with every day are in a car accident. Something has gone wrong. And what I coach leaders to do is, you don't have to solve it. But what you do have to do is say, "I'm right here. How can I help?"
Indeed.
"I'm right here."
Yeah.
"What happened?" And that will open the door to a relationship that will grow and prosper. You just have to be fully present in those crucible moments. And we all have them in large scale or small scale every day. And we tend to get so caught up in our own moments that we're not paying attention to the moments around us. And the mark of a great leader is to be tuned in to the world around you and not preoccupied with the world inside.
Wonderful and so powerful. So, I mean, with such strong words, let me ask you the very last question. I recently had Sir Ronald Cohen on the podcast, and he had a sort of epiphany moment on his 60th birthday, and he decided to leave his job as a venture capitalist and do something that he considered to be more important, more impactful, more purposeful. He realized that giving back was one of his core values. So, Doug, I mean, what do you feel called to do? What are your dreams? How do you want to make the world a better place? What inspires you? And what are you working towards?
I am doing what I was called to do, and I was doing it when I was serving these companies. I was helping people realize their full potential. And I can't imagine anything more fulfilling. At this point, we keep track of the people that have worked either for me, directly for me, or one level down that I have worked with. We keep track of how many CEOs there are. And we have nearly 60 now. Those 60 people, in my opinion, are better off for having known me. And I have had some influence on their journey. And I see the influence they're having on the journeys of their companies around the world. And that's where I can add value, because I know what it's like to be in the arena, just like you do. I'm not opining on it from some academic chair somewhere. Yeah. I've been there, done that. You've been there, done that. And I can help them find their footing I'm not trying to tell them how to live their lives, but I can help them find their footing in a way that'll lift their enterprise up. And I love doing it. I can't imagine anything better.
What a wonderful conclusion, Doug. I mean, I'm right here. How can I help? To me, that's probably one of the best quotes I would have in my Positive Leadership podcast from a wonderful positive leader. Thank you so much for this amazing moment we spent, Doug, and I wish you the very best in accomplishing your purpose one day at a time.
Thank you, and I look forward to the next time our paths cross. I love the work that's going on within your company now, and I am cheering you all on from the sidelines.
Thanks so much, Doug. Thank you. You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast. We've got over 50 episodes now available, inspiring conversation with leaders from the world of politics, sport, as well as business, psychology, and coaching. Check them out. And head over to my LinkedIn page to subscribe to my monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You, which is packed with top tips on how to grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. If you've enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to share it. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. JP, thanks for listening. Goodbye.